Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso. Three people were killed and 12 others wounded in a rocket attack on a United Nations base camp in northern Mali. A UN statement says more than 30 rockets were fired on a UN Malian peacekeeping force compound in Kidal, killing one peacekeeper and injuring 8 other soldiers. The shells also struck a nearby encampment for Arab nomads, leaving 2 dead and 4 wounded. Officials say forces immediately returned fire from the camp in retaliation. However, it was not immediately clear who is responsible for the attack early Sunday. Malaysia Sunday released an interim investigation report on the disappearance of the Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 exactly a year after the Boeing 777 disappeared without a trace with 239 passengers and crew on board. Prime Minister Najib Razak said in a statement that Malaysia remains committed to the search and hopeful the plane will be found. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott weighed in on the search.
Well, it can't go on forever, but as long as there are reasonable leads, the search will go on. We've got 60,000 square kilometres that is the subject of this search. If that's unsuccessful, there's another 60,000 square kilometres that we intend to search. And as I said, we are reasonably confident of finding the plane.
And Yemen's internationally recognized but nationally disputed president shored up his makeshift seat of power in the port city of Aden Sunday. Comes as the country's defense minister fled the capital of Sana'a to join him. General Mahmoud al-Sabahi defected to Yemen's second city on Sunday, fleeing the Houthi-controlled capital. This is VOA News. Russian authorities Sunday charged 2 Chechens with the murder of opposition leader Boris Nemtsov and detained 3 others for questioning in his killing late last month with inside of the Kremlin. All 5 appeared in a Moscow court as officials continued their investigation of the February 27th shooting death of Nemtsov. State news media identified the 2 officially accused of murdering Nemtsov as Zair Dadayev, he's a deputy commander for the Chechen police, and Anzar Gubushev, who worked for a private security company in Moscow. Authorities identified one of those detained for questioning as Gubushev's younger brother. Dadayev's mother spoke to Interfax news agency. She says, "I can't believe it. He could not have committed this crime." She said her son has worked for Chechen law enforcement agencies for the last decade. International Women's Day is celebrated on March 8th, and thousands of events around the world mark the economic, political, and social achievements of women. The day is an opportunity to call for greater equality so women and their families can live fully successful lives. At the Vatican, Pope Francis gave a special blessing to women around the world.
Una occasione per ribadire.
He says, in a world where women are marginalized in a sterile world because women don't just bear life, but transmit to us the ability to see otherwise, they see things differently. They transmit to us the ability to understand the world with different eyes. You can read more on International Women's Day at voanews.com. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says it's up to Tehran to show the world and to prove that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful. Speaking alongside his French counterpart, French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius in Paris Saturday, Kerry said progress had been made in the talks.
We have a critical couple of weeks ahead of us. We're all mindful that the days are ticking by, but we're not feeling a sense of urgency that we have to get any deal. We have to get the right deal.
Again, that is U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. The militant group Boko Haram has pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. It comes amid reports that a series of bombings have killed more than 50 people in Nigeria's Borno State, where Boko Haram is active. The jihadist monitoring group site on Saturday quoted Boko Haram as saying that they announced their allegiance in a video purporting to be from the Nigerian rebel group. At least 10 foreign workers are missing after Islamic State militants attacked a Libyan oil field. Libyan officials say security forces have retaken the Al Ghani field, which the militants attacked on Friday, killing several guards. No one has made any demands for the return of the unaccounted workers. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
This is an attempt to look for support from other areas, but it's just clear that the armed forces and government of Nigeria will stay committed.
Boko Haram pledges allegiance to the Islamic State. We'll have a reaction from the Nigerian government.
Clearly are failing to understand the provisions of the law. There has not been any procedures that has expelled these members of parliament from the MDCT.
The Speaker of the Zimbabwean Parliament this week is expected to rule over a dispute among lawmakers.
People with disabilities, especially women, are disproportionately vulnerable to violence. They're actually 3 to 4 times more likely to experience violence in their lifetimes.
And it's International Women's Day today, and the theme for this year's celebrations is recognizing the contributions women make to society. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A spokesman for the Nigerian government says the military will not be deterred in its ongoing offensives against Boko Haram militants, despite the group's pledge of allegiance to the Islamic State extremist group. Michael Merry, who is also the Director General of the National Orientation Agency, told me the move is due to the success of the continued military offensive launched by the Nigerian army and its allies on the militants.
Well, it's sad, although it's something that we've always thought existed, that there was a link or an attempt to get the linkage or attention of ISIS at rest. But clearly, the armed forces of Nigeria and allies would continue to discharge the offensive with a view to getting those areas free. It will not deter us. It will only make us more stronger and committed to the fight against terror in the land. The fact that the armed forces have been recording a number of successes of recent may have led to this new development, because they have been decapacitated, they have been degraded, and most of them have been dispersed from various camps and certain communities where they've always they had their presence. So I think this is an attempt to look for support from other areas, but it's just clear that the armed forces and government of Nigeria will stay committed to this fight, will not be deterred, will throw in everything to defeat Boko Haram.
Some are suggesting that Boko Haram has resorted to suicide bombings based on the military offensive being launched by Nigeria and its allies. What can you tell me about this development?
Again, we had even issued an advisory that this could be possible because of the trends that we saw. And so they are really actually dispersed. And so the best thing is to go to distant communities and also attack soft targets, motor parks and markets. So there is heightened security and encouraging messages to citizens so they can be more alert and to report such suspicious objects or persons to the nearest authority.
What is the current situation on the ground concerning the military offensive against Boko Haram? There were reports of Maiduguri attack recently by Boko Haram, but what has been the current situation on the ground so far as we speak?
Well, attacks have actually receded from the city of Maiduguri, although last week or 2 weeks ago there was an attempt at Gokonduga, which is about 55 kilometers from Maiduguri. But most of these attacks have been repelled, and the insurgents pursued with devastating consequences on their part. Of course, the latest attacks in Maiduguri are from suicide bombers who detonate in crowded places and motor parks, as I said earlier. Only yesterday, along Damaku Maiduguri Road by Benishe, a town around after Damaku was Maiduguri, two suicide bombers traveling in a golf vehicle. I was fighting the military, alighted from their vehicle and went into the bush to detonate explosive materials that they obviously had had with them on this whole ground. So there's heightened security and alertness. And I assure you, the best that can be done will be done.
There were reports that Chadian soldiers were prevented from further going into Boko Haram stronghold by the Nigerian military. What can you tell me about this report?
No, I don't have information about that. Only that I know they have had a series of collaboration and the number of protocols that have been signed and they are working. No, I have no information that to the contrary of the implementation of the protocol.
Michael Merry is a Nigerian government spokesman and the Director General of the National Orientation Agency. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Meanwhile, for analysis on the Boko Haram's pledge to the Islamic State, or IS, my colleague Douglas Impuga reached Professor Walid Faris, an advisor to the U.S. House of Representatives on Middle East and author of The Lost Spring, to find out what he made of this development.
This is a big deal. This is a major shift. Boko Haram is basically the largest jihadi group in subtropical Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. By shifting to ISIS, it gives ISIS a hand south of Libya, of Egypt, of Algeria and Morocco. Now we want to make sure that when they pledge to ISIS, it means that they're going to integrate their caliphate. So that will be seen in the next few months. But this is a major geopolitical shift.
So if this audio clip is correct and true, what does it say to the spread of ISIL influence around the world?
Well, ISIS is spreading because it's presenting a reality in Iraq and Syria. It's a quote-unquote caliphate on the ground. It has the flag. It has an army. It has taxes. There is no other jihadi group that can compete with us. And we have projected, if you remember, that eventually most of the jihadist groups, if Al-Qaeda cannot really achieve what ISIS is achieving, most of them will slowly and gradually join the mothership in Syria and Iraq.
And given the fact that Boko Haram may benefit from Islamic State's infrastructure, resources and military capabilities, how do you think the region, the governments in the region in West Africa will manage to control this threat?
Well, it is going to be a problem, not just for Nigeria, but the surrounding African countries of Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and others as well, because Boko has demonstrated that it can spread across the borders. We may even see something more serious if Boko Haram would start to connect across the Sahara, across the Sahel, with groups operating as far as Libya or Mali. Now, if that happens, then we're talking about an international problem in Africa that has to be addressed by the international community.
Professor Walid Faris is an advisor to the United States House of Representatives on Middle East and author of The Lost Spring. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga. Ghana marked 58 years of independence on Friday, but some Ghanaians are unhappy about the current state of affairs in the country. Some say the country should be in a better position than it is now. Ben Evson is a pollster and managing editor of the Daily Dispatch, an independent Ghanaian newspaper. He joins us live via telephone link from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Good evening, Ben.
Good evening, and good evening to our listeners.
Wonderful. Now, Ben, what is the mood in the country as the nation celebrated its 50 years of independence from Britain?
Well, Peter, the Ghana downturn has been the ongoing electricity problem, where now we have 24 hours of, in selected area, 24 hours of power off, 12 hours of power on. And the president, in State of Nation address, promised that he will not manage it, because the increases in generation are not tallied with the increase in population, but he will fix it. And if he's able to fix it, it's an election changer to his benefit. If he doesn't, he'll be in serious trouble next year come election time.
Now, Ben, some Ghanaians I spoke with say successive governments, including this one, that came after First President Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, were only concerned with either staying in power you know, talking about the military regime, or winning elections. So they failed to improve and expand the country's infrastructure to meet population explosion. What's your take?
I think that given the dynamics of the population, 79.8% of the population are below 40 years of age. They are articulate. They have access to social media. And I think that President Mahama is in a fix. You know, he's like he's climbed a tree. On top of the tree is a snake. Below is a lion. People are now going to demand infrastructure developments as a measure of trying to retain a government in power or voting it out. And he's rolled out a number of plans that if he's able to achieve them, it will be to his electoral benefit. If he doesn't, it will be to his electoral disadvantage.
Now, has the government given the population confidence about its ability to administer and run the country effectively due to the ongoing challenges, economic and otherwise, about resolving the challenges that the people face?
Well, I think that the IMF, I think, is subject to approval from Washington, but the IMF $1 billion bailout, given the fact that the electrical problems, the power generation problems, have actually slowed down the economy down to those who sell ice water in the streets. If the IMF Washington headquarters approved the IMF bailout, and he's able to solve the electricity problems and start the free SHS for day students, I believe that he'll be on the path of addressing the basic needs of Ghanaians. That, I think, is the challenge that he's facing now concerning roads, access to food-growing areas, and then credibility in terms of health insurance coverage.
Now, what are the expectations of citizens in Ghana in view of the prevailing socioeconomic challenges?
The average Ghanaian expects that come maybe by the end of this year, access to health insurance should be increased. The average Ghanaian expects that this 24-hour problem with electricity, 12-hour light, will be a thing of the past, because the president said he's not going to manage it like previous government. He's going to try and fix it. I mean, the free SHS for these students starts. That to be what the Ghanaians will expect, that once that starts, whoever wins 2016 elections will have to continue that path to improve the average man's basic standard of living.
People have raised concerns about corruption in the country or among officials in government positions. Has there been measures implemented to weed out corruption in the country?
I feel that with time, many Ghanaians are now realizing that the corruption canker is not with the 80 or so ministers that have perpetually been the focus of the media. Civil servants and individuals are the greatest perpetrators of corruption, because politicians should be appointed and they'll be dismissed. It's the civil servants who have the template for corruption. And I think that if our Whistleblower Act is well publicized, the Whistleblower Act briefly says that if you're able to stop government losing money, you get 10% reward and you are protected. If Ghanaians are aware of this, I'm sure quite a number of corruption practices will cease, and corruption must be made unattractive by harsher punishment and going after people's illegally acquired wealth with corrupt money.
Well, Ben, the laws are on the books. Implementation sometimes has been selective. What do you think can be done in this case to even the playing field to ensure transparency and accountability?
Peter, I think that if our churches start, it will be very good. If the house of God starts. I've never heard of any church which has turned down a donation of, let's say, $20,000 from somebody who is a driver or a low-paying official in a public service. If that starts, people will gradually shun those who have corrupt money. But the point is that if people continue to glorify those who have money, notwithstanding how they got it, it is going to be a lot. But the government will have to step up. they will have to make it unattractive. Otherwise, the maxim for corrupt parties will be still and still big.
Now, Ben, will Ghana's first president, talking about Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, will he be proud or happy about the current situation in the country?
Given what Nkrumah did, foreseeing the potential, I think that he'll be a bit disappointed that succeeding president after him have not been bold and decisive. But the average Ghanaian will look back and say that given the problems in sub-Saharan Africa, so far, touch wood, Ghana has been lucky. But some of us believe that the line between sanity and chaos is a very thin one, and our stability of peace should not be taken for granted.
Thank you very much, Ben. Ben Epstein is a pollster and managing editor of the Daily Dispatch, an independent Ghanaian newspaper. He joined us live from the capital, Accra. The Speaker of the Zimbabwean Parliament is expected to rule on a key dispute between the two opposition factions of the Movement for Democratic Change, MDC. The move is expected to affect the status of some members of Parliament and senators who the main MDC faction wants expelled from the House. To explore these scenarios, VOA Zimbabwe Service Studio 7's Blessing Zulu turned to MDC renewal spokesman Jacob Mafume and MDC Changrai spokesman Obet Gutu. He first asked Gutu to confirm the recall bid.
The Secretary General of the party wrote a letter to both the Speaker of the National Assembly and also to the President of the Senate, recalling 17 members of the National Assembly, as well as four senators. And the recall is in terms of Section 129.1K of the Constitution of Zimbabwe, which briefly states that a member of parliament who is elected into parliament on the ticket of a particular political party will automatically lose their seat if they cease being a member of that party.
Mr. Mafume, your response.
Yes, I think clearly this is not the first time that Gotu and his colleagues have written a letter to the Speaker. So this matter has already been ruled over by the Speaker. They have written actually on the 8th of May, and they wrote again on the 8th of August or October last year to ask for the expulsion of members of parliament. They clearly are failing to understand the provisions of the law. There has not been any procedures that has expelled these members of parliament from the MDCT. In fact, their leader is the one that was expelled from the MDCT. So there is an attempt to mimic or to copy ZANU-PF in doing illegal things, which is a clumsy attempt and is an unconstitutional attempt.
Mr. Gutu, is it true that you don't have any legal leg to stand on?
I'm actually bamboozled, coming from Mafume, that this is a floor-closing provision. Last time I checked, I understand he's supposed to be a lawyer. If he really familiarizes himself with the provisions of Section 129, subsection 1, subparagraph K, that are very clear and unambiguous. They say that if a member of parliament ceases to be or to belong to the political party under whose ticket he or she was voted into parliament, he or she automatically loses that position of being a parliamentarian.
You cannot just wake up and say, because you believe in a certain position and a certain leader, therefore, these other people no longer belong to that political party, or technically they have called themselves Gematoks, therefore they are a different political party. No, that cannot be the law, and that is not the law of the land. So we are very clear that this process that has been initiated is the similar process of writing letters. And the other irony is that the opposition parties have said they will not participate in by-elections. Now, if you write a letter, it means there will be by-elections in 90 days. And are they willing to donate those seats to ZANU-PF?
Mr. Gutu, there is this question posed by Mr. Mafume on the by-elections. He's saying that you have indicated that you are not going to participate in those by-elections. You are calling for the recall of these parliamentarians. What happens if they are recalled?
A blessing. That is a very clear position. We are just proceeding by way of a Congress resolution.
MDC Renewal Team spokesman Jacob Mafume, you also heard from MDC Tsvangirai spokesman Obed Gutu. The two were speaking with viewers, Zimbabwe Service Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from Harare. Sunday, March 8th, that is today, is an International Women's Day. This year's theme, Making It Happen, recognizes the contributions women make to society. But a rights group is also using the occasion to call attention to women and girls with disabilities. It says they are at a greater risk of sexual violence. Viewers Jody Kapwa has more on the story from Washington.
Human Rights Watch says all governments should ensure that women and girls with disabilities are included in programs to prevent gender-based violence. The group has released what it calls a resource designed for people with disabilities. HRW's Disability Rights Director, Shanta Rao Bariga, says this information must get to the people who need it most.
People with disabilities, especially women, are disproportionately vulnerable to violence. They're actually 3 to 4 times more likely to experience violence in their lifetimes, yet what we found in a number of countries is that they are not even getting information on what is violence and what they can do to get help.
She says for some, it can be difficult to discern what inappropriate behavior is.
This document that we've released is in what's called easy-to-read format, which is particularly designed for people who have intellectual disabilities or learning delays and have never gotten information on what is appropriate type of behavior. So, for example, you know, what's often called good touch and bad touch. When a family member, friend, or even someone in their community asks them to do things that they don't realize is not really okay and they are allowed to say no, but never really got that lesson.
Bariga says women and girls with disabilities often face multiple barriers accessing sexual and reproductive health care, as well as psychological and criminal justice services.
When it comes to women with disabilities, they still are hidden. We have been documenting this issue in a number of countries, and in some cases, they have never told their stories of rape and sexual violence to anyone else before they told us. This population is invisible. We should keep in mind there's 1 billion people with disabilities in the world, and that's 15% of the world's population.
The Human Rights Watch official says there are a number of reasons why people with disabilities are not included in gender violence prevention and response programs.
One, there's a belief in many countries that people with disabilities are asexual, that they don't need this kind of information on sexuality, so they're not included. There are also physical and communication barriers. Is the information provided in sign language or in Braille, or is it provided in schools that are accessible to children? We even have cases of children with disabilities who were told not to go into the HIV prevention class because they don't need this information.
She says abuses by family members or primary caregivers against children may be the hardest to detect. HRW gives the example of a 16-year-old Zambian girl with intellectual disabilities. She had given birth to 3 children. It's suspected she was raped by her father.
People with disabilities are often dependent on their family members or caregivers in so many ways, financial support and just general everyday living support. So it's difficult for them to actually come out and speak out against violence committed by these individuals.
Bariga says governments should consult with people with disabilities and the organizations that advocate for them. She says they can also translate information into more accessible formats. For example, using simple language would make it easier for those with intellectual disabilities or those who lack education. She also says the issue should be part of the new Sustainable Development Goals being developed this year. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
A very good evening to you, Peter, and to all our listeners across Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, March 8th. The 2015 Africa Under-20 Football Championship kicks off today, Sunday. The West African nation of Senegal is the host. Senegal, which qualified automatically, is joined by seven other countries. They are Nigeria, Congo, and Ivory Coast, which together with Senegal are in Group A, and Ghana, South Africa, Mali, and Zambia in Group B. Defending champion Egypt did not qualify for the 2015 championship, as it was eliminated in the third round of the qualifiers by Congo. The tournament is due to run from today, March 8th, to March 22nd. It is also doubling as a qualifier for the 2015 FIFA Under-20 World Cup to be hosted by New Zealand from May 30th to June 20th. In more football news, the Algerian Football Federation, FAF, is not happy with the French club Olympique Lyonnais. FAF accuses the French club of preventing midfielder Nabil Fekir from choosing to play for the Algerian national team instead of France. On Friday, Fekir denied that he had chosen Algeria over France. He said on the club's website that he will reveal his choice at the end of March. But the Algerian FA sees the situation differently. We called up Nabil Fekir because he called coach Christian Gokko to tell him he had chosen to wear the Algerian shirt. FAF president Mohamed Raoulawa was quoted as saying by France Football magazine on Saturday, "We were surprised by the official statement published on the club's website, and it proves that the club played a part in this affair," the FAF president said. Meanwhile, Senegalese Papi Cissé, who stars for English Premiership club Newcastle United, has been banned for seven matches. Also banned for six matches is Manchester United defender Johnny Evans. The hammer of the English Football Association fell on the two players on Saturday for spitting at each other during an English Premier League match. The incident, which was not spotted by match officials, occurred in the 38th minute of Manchester United's 1-0 away win at St. James's Park on Wednesday. Well, there is better news from another African footballer playing abroad. After scoring both goals for Fiorentina against Juventus in the 2-1 win in the Coppa Italia semi-final on Thursday, Egypt winger Mohamed Salah is basking in the glory of his superb performance. The 22-year-old attacker has produced a string of scintillating actions since his arrival in Italy last month on loan from Chelsea. He has scored six goals in seven appearances on all fronts, three goals in Serie A, one in the Europa League, and two in Italian Cup play. Turning to golf news, the four-day Africa Open Golf Championship is due to round off today, Sunday. The championship is being played at the East London Golf Club in the southeast coast of South Africa. Here is reporter Mark Tompkins after the close of third round action on Saturday.
South Africa's Trevor Fisher Jr. takes a two-shot lead into the final round of the Africa Open after a superb round of 63 today saw him top the leaderboard. And he'll be in the final group out with England's Matt Ford, who had been the overnight leader. A tougher day out on course for Ford today with a double bogey on the par 4 8th and a bogey on the par 4 14th. But red figures through the card saw him finish at 3-under with a 69 and two shots behind Fisher at the top of the leaderboard. Next comes another South African, Jaco van Sail. Such a great record in this event, and after 10 months out through injury, from getting his form back together after a tied second place finish last week. Morten Orre Madsen's nicely in touch as well after an early round of 64, one of the early starters this morning, pulling himself into contention. He's one of four players on 10-under par alongside Jorge Campillo, John Parry and Eduardo de la Riva from Spain. But it's Trevor Fisher Jr. and Matt Ford that will be in the final group for round four. Fisher leads by two on 16 under par.
Many thanks, Mark. Finally, President Sepp Blatter of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has asked Iran to end its ban on women watching football matches, describing the situation as intolerable. He says when he traveled to Iran in November 2013, he was not only confronted with huge popular enthusiasm from football, but also a law forbidding women from attending football matches. Writing in FIFA's weekly magazine, he said he raised the topic at his meeting with the president of Iran and came away with the impression that the situation could change over the medium term. However, nothing has happened. A collective stadium ban still applies to women in Iran, despite the existence of a thriving women's football organization. This cannot continue. Hence my appeal to the Iranian authorities. Open the nation's football stadiums to women. On that note, we wrap up this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Clote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
I don't know why. I'll send me. Makumaya ma,
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Woman's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. When China's Prime Minister, Li Keqiang, delivered his work report of budget last Thursday in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing before the third session of China's 12th National People's Congress, China's relations with Africa came into focus. Of course, this was not the primary focus of the Chinese premier. Clearly, he intended to enunciate what is now referred to as the new normal of China's economic development. It has become customary to expect very high economic growth from China, and this high growth has helped to stimulate global economic development. Now, however, China is adopting a new approach that may affect global economic performance. Premier Li projected a growth rate for China in 2015 of 7%, the lowest growth rate for 24 years. This new approach was discernible last year when the targeted growth rate was 7.5% and the actual growth rate was 7.4%, again the lowest in 25 years. Western governments were worried when Premier Li also announced that the military budget would be at 10% for 2015, even though this rate is only one-fourth of the U.S. military budget. But Western countries often complain that there is little transparency in China's military budget. For Prime Minister Li, the new low rate of China is intended to elevate China's economic from resource orientation to innovation orientation. Some Chinese commentators have even speculated of China's wanting to establish a Silicon Valley in China, a la that in California. It should be noted also that Prime Minister Li spoke at length of continuing vigorously the fight against corruption in China and the need to clean the environment. In this regard, reference was made to China's cooperation with Africa in the environment. Interestingly, while China was promoting a slowdown of its economy, its key rival in Asia, India, was going in the opposite direction. The new Indian government of Premier Narendra Modi recently published its target growth for 2015 at 8.5%. What are the implications of China's new economic slowdown? In recent years, China has expanded trade with Africa, and Africa in turn has benefited from this trade relationship. At the last African Union summit, China reaffirmed its commitment to assist Africa in its economic development. China plans to accelerate its infrastructural assistance and transfer of technology in Africa. The modernization of the railway link in East Africa from Nairobi, Kenya, to the wider East African countries will continue, owing to the shift from resources to innovation. China may indeed import less resources from Africa in 2015, but investments may increase. China is the leading country that trades with the largest number of countries in the global community. China has adopted the practice of using local currency for trade, thus reducing its reliance on the existing reserve currencies of the US dollar, United Kingdom sterling, and euros. Just last week, Australia imposed new taxes on China's affordable house investment, and Chinese business people are now thinking of shifting that investment to South Africa. It has been stated over and over again by some commentators that China's trade with Africa is a form of neocolonialism. However, going as far back as Chairman Mao Zedong and Premier Zhou Enlai, it is almost as if in China's foreign policy, it is written in concrete that China will never forget the role Africa played in 1971 in restoring China's vote in the United Nations. China has always lived up to its commitment to the African country and its people. And now China is moving ahead with its peacekeeping in Africa by dispatching for the first time a peacekeeping contingent as contribution to the United Nations peacekeeping in southern Sudan. I thank you.
And thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Adeyemi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us and ask the elders in Africa, saying, if a toad jumps around in the daytime, it's either chasing something or something is chasing it. I'm your host, Peter Plotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 8th, many nations around the world observed the United Nations International Women's Day. It is a day to celebrate women's achievements throughout history and across nations. It is also an occasion to reflect on past struggles and accomplishments, and to consider what still must be done to improve the lives and opportunities of women. The Charter of the United Nations, signed in San Francisco in 1945, was the first international agreement to proclaim the equal rights of men and women. But even though women have made great strides since then, there is still much work to be done. Advancing the status of women and girls is critical to achieving successful outcomes for U.S. foreign policy priorities. The U.S. National Security Strategy notes that countries are more peaceful and prosperous when women are accorded full and equal rights and opportunity. The evidence is clear. Research indicates that nations that invest in women's employment, health, and education tend to have greater economic growth and improved health and education for children. The United States invests in women not only because it is the moral thing to do, but because it is one of the most strategic actions we can take. In fact, women are one of a country's greatest untapped resources, and they invest as much as 97% of their income into their families and communities. When a mother is educated, her children's chances of survival and of leading healthier lives increase. When women are free to participate in the economic life of a country, the conditions for sustainable development and prosperity will more likely take root. Any society striving to flourish must begin by empowering its women and by promoting for them the same rights that men already enjoy. On International Women's Day, we celebrate and honor women. We also renew our commitment to make the world a place where women are not excluded or marginalized, but are free to realize their full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.